Hi, I'm Rebecca Davis.
And I'm April Fulton, and this is your Health, a weekly podcast from NPR's Science Desk.
This week, does the cost of some required vaccines outweigh their benefits?
And a new poll shows the cost of organic food is keeping a lot of buyers away.
We'll also hear a lovely story picked just for you, April, about the strength and medical support pregnant women get from each other.
Aww. But first, we'll take a deep breath. With some patients trying to deal with tinnitus, chronic ringing in the ears. It's a problem in the brain that doctors don't fully understand, and usually there's nothing they can do to treat it. Allison Aubrey tells the story of a chance meeting between a researcher and a patient, which led to a promising treatment.
If you've ever had moments in your life when you just feel stuck, well, Jennifer Gans feels your pain. She's a researcher at the University of California in San Francisco, and she recalls one night a few years back when she was trying to finish a proposal.
Well, I remember sitting in front of my computer and found myself going over things over and over and over again and getting myself worked up.
Looking back, Jennifer was just nervous. The next morning, she was scheduled to pitch her project to the chair of her department. She wanted to study the effectiveness of meditation and mindfulness training, something she was experimenting with in her own life, for people with chronic ringing in the ears. She knew to get the study started, she not only needed approval, she also needed funding. Looking to blow off some steam that night, she headed out to a museum to see a traveling exhibit on King Tut.
So I was just walking along with headphones on, and I noticed that there was a man in front of me who just seemed to know everything there is about King Tut.
Now, he wasn't a tour guide. He just seemed to be another visitor, albeit a really informed one, talking with a couple of friends.
And so I just took my earphones off, and I started listening to him speak.
Oh, yes, absolutely. I remember it.
That's Doug Tilden, the man from the museum who was doing all the talking.
Jennifer was sort of hanging on the end of our group, listening to what I had to say. And then when I finished, she stopped me, introduced herself, and asked me how come I knew so much about King Tut.
Tilden explained he was an archaeology buff. It was a hobby for him, and he happened to be a patron of the exhibit, a lead sponsor. So here's where the story takes a twist. Jennifer says by introducing herself, she really just wanted to thank him for letting her tag along. But as the conversation carried on, Doug Tilden said to her, "Well, Jennifer, what do you do?"
I said, "Well, it's funny you ask, because tomorrow is a big day for me."
She explained her study on tinnitus, or ringing in the ears.
And his mouth just dropped open. And I said, "What?"
Turns out Tilden has the condition. He has struggled with it for years. To make a long story short, he did some serious vetting of her project. He realized the meditation training she proposed didn't require people to escape to ashrams or live among monks. This was an 8-week class, adapted from mindfulness-based stress reduction, or MBSR for short. It teaches simple techniques, such as using slow breathing to focus your attention. A bunch of studies testing MBSR with arthritis patients and those living in chronic pain have documented significant improvements in people's quality of life. And Tilden was curious if the same might be true for people with tinnitus. So he wrote her a check to fund the study. How's that for a chance meeting?
It's amazing what it turned into.
One of the first patients Jennifer recruited into the study was Robert DeMong, a 65-year-old retired engineer who had learned to cope with the ringing in his ears by drowning it out with as many sounds as he could: wind, traffic, music, noise generators. So the idea of quiet, silent meditation?
I thought, that's disastrous for me.
What he didn't realize at the time was that he could learn to accept the ring. Through a daily breathing exercise he learned in class, he worked on acknowledging the ring instead of running from it.
I began to get used to breathing into the tinnitus, breathing into the ringing, and I got used to it.
The ringing did not go away, but he says his anxiety about the ringing did. He found himself repeating a daily mantra.
Acknowledge and let it be. Just acknowledge and let it be.
Jennifer Gann says she's finding that when people see they have a choice in how they react to the ringing, they tend to do better. They learn to separate the sensation of the sound from all the emotions about it.
The subjects often find that, you know what, this is not so bad and I can live through this in this moment.
Now Gann says the challenge is to keep up this practice, turning the mindfulness training of staying in the moment into a daily habit. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
Thank you.
pleased to welcome Scott Hensley, our health blogger. Hi, Scott.
Hi, April. Hi, Rebecca.
Hi, Scott. So, Scott, tell us what's in the blog this week that you want to talk about.
We've got a lot about food, I'll tell you that. And the first post that I think we're going to talk about was an announcement from the First Lady about trying to bring more fruits and vegetables to areas that don't have them. And I think, April, you might be able to tell us more about it.
Yeah, I edited the post. So basically, the First Lady made an announcement about a lot of big supermarket chains and corporations who have made pledges to actually come in to food deserts and open up grocery stores.
So what's a food desert, April?
I knew you were going to ask that. So basically, a food desert is a place where it's pretty hard to find a grocery store. And by grocery store, we mean not the corner store, not the gas station, but a place where you could get a variety of healthier food like fruits and vegetables.
Is this going to make a difference?
Well, I think that the First Lady is making a big case that it will make a difference, but it's not necessarily true. She wants to improve access to fruits and vegetables and healthier foods, and that's only one part of the equation. In fact, there was a study out last week that suggested that the access to fruits and vegetables in grocery stores doesn't necessarily reduce obesity rates, that it may have more to do with how easy it is to get to a fast food restaurant. So this may be just one piece of the pie.
All right. So what about cost? I know there was a post this week about the price of organic food, which apparently a solid majority of Americans really want to buy, but cost is holding them back.
Cost is a problem. We have been wondering about how people view organic foods and locally grown foods. So with our partners, Thomson Reuters, we did a poll recently where we asked people, how do they view organic foods? And you're right. A majority of Americans prefer organic foods, given the choice, but the cost is a problem.
Mm-hmm. So, Scott, I know that from having read the post that people who did buy organic food do so because they are worried about toxins and they want to support local agriculture. So who's not buying or not interested in organic food these days?
One group stood out, Rebecca, as not being very interested in organics. Senior citizens, people 65 and up, weren't as interested in buying organics. The majority either didn't care or preferred non-organic food.
There was a couple more posts on food you can talk about today,
more.
Right?
Oh, I want to hear about all those. When I go into a restaurant and they have those nice little laminated menus and you open it up and they have a big red emblazoned circle with the calorie count next to the dish that I'm about to order for $9.99.
Caveat emptor. So we have written quite a bit about the health overhaul law, which had in the thousands of pages a requirement that chain restaurants start putting the nutrition information on the menu, and that's now going into effect. And some researchers from Tufts University said, we're going to check this out.
Because they didn't believe them?
I think it was a trust but verify. So they wanted to go out
and
they went out and bought all sorts of food from a bunch of the biggest chains, the ones that would be in almost everyone's neighborhood, Outback Steakhouse, Pizza Hut, Boston Market, Olive Garden, and a whole bunch of others. It was more than 260 different food items, and then they sent them to the lab. And what they found out was there was quite a bit of variation in the actual calorie counts versus what was on the menu.
Okay, let me guess that the restaurants had rounded down, making the calorie counts look lower. Not lying, but just, you know, rounding down a little bit.
Rebecca, more than half of the items actually had fewer calories than were on the menu.
Really?
Yeah. But the ones that were too high, some of them were real doozies. Hmm. So one in five of the foods contained 100 or more calories more than the menu said. And some of them were real whoppers.
So what were the worst offenders?
One of the worst was the calorie-rich blue cheese wedge side salad from Outback Steakhouse. And that was off by more than 600 calories. It was 600 calories too low on the menu description.
Wow.
And another, this one, I don't know where they went wrong, but a side order of chips and salsa at On the Border Mexican Grill and Cantina was too low by more than 1,000 calories.
Oh.
So those were some big discrepancies.
Wow.
That is, considering your daily diet should be in the 2,000 calorie range, you're talking about quite a lot more calories than you probably think you're getting.
Right. Even if you're sharing those chips and salsa, that's a lot of calories to go around.
Huh. And how do they account for the discrepancies? Why such a big difference from what the lab found?
Well, the National Restaurant Association commented to us about this, and they said that it's working with its members. This is still kind of a new thing for a lot of them. And they also said, you know, these are dishes that are made by hand, so there can be some variation on that front. One of the researchers said, you know, it's important that the numbers be as accurate as they can be, because even a change of 10 or 20 calories on something per day can make a difference.
Huge difference, yeah. Mm-hmm. Wow. Well, that's very interesting. Thanks very much.
I guess we'll be watching what we eat even more. Thank you.
You bet. Talk to you next week.
Can't wait.
Now we turn to a question of costs and benefits. Thanks to vaccines, diseases like polio, measles, and tuberculosis that used to kill thousands have become relatively rare.
But some vaccines have also become much more expensive. Now public health officials are trying to sort out whether it's worth the cost to require people to get vaccinated for diseases like meningitis, which are dangerous but extremely rare. John Hamilton has the story.
New vaccines are approved by the FDA. But how many people get them depends largely on a group called ACIP, the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. Both the government and private insurers use ACIP recommendations to decide which vaccines they'll pay for. As the cost of vaccines has risen, ACIP members have found themselves spending more and more time on economics. William Schaffner from Vanderbilt University says one vaccine that highlights the issue protects against bacteria that can cause meningitis.
If there's an illness that is highly notable and feared by the population, that's it. No parent wants their child to have this illness.
It tends to attack young people and can kill in a matter of hours. Outbreaks on college campuses have received a lot of media attention. So back in 2005, ACIP recommended that every adolescent in the U.S. get the vaccine. It costs nearly $100 a dose, which means hundreds of millions of dollars a year paid by the government and private insurers. But the bacteria infect only a couple of thousand people in the U.S. each year, and that number was going down even before the vaccine arrived. Schaffner, who is part of an ACIP group that studies meningitis, says in this case, vaccination is a very expensive way to save lives. And yet, he says,
curiously, the cost-benefit analyses regarding the use of meningococcal vaccine are usually acknowledged but put to the side.
Not anymore. Late last year, ACIP members gathered in Atlanta to discuss whether to recommend a booster shot. Again and again, committee members and public health officials came back to the cost.
Is it appropriate to almost double the amount of money spent on this program?
One of the drivers of this analysis is the price of the vaccine.
So the cost per vaccine will be $189.
Approximate cost of $387 million annually.
Nearly $400 million to prevent about 23 deaths. Ultimately, ACIP went ahead and recommended the booster, even though it doubled the cost. But Schaffner says that debate reveals how much things have changed at ACIP.
Back in the day in the 1980s, cost-effectiveness, indeed even the cost of vaccines, just wasn't discussed, in part because vaccines were so much cheaper then.
Now, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention spends more than $3.5 billion a year just on vaccines for children. And in February, at another ACIP meeting, CDC Director Thomas Frieden made it clear that he's frustrated.
Most newer products and new formulations of old products have come at substantially higher prices. And we've also seen prices rising after initial federal contracts were set, and prices failing to fall when vaccine schedules are compressed or a second vaccine manufacturer enters the market.
For their part, manufacturers say most vaccines still aren't very profitable. They also note that when prices were lower, companies stopped developing new vaccines or simply got out of the vaccine business. So now, Schaffner says, ACIP members find themselves in the difficult position of deciding not just how much good a vaccine can do, but whether it's worth the cost.
I think it's fair to say it's that aspect of their deliberations with which they're least familiar.
ACIP meetings now include presentations by experts on cost-effectiveness. But Mark Pauly, a health economist at the University of Pennsylvania, says that doesn't solve the fundamental problem.
You do have a rough idea that if it's $1.98 per life saved, that sounds like a good thing to do. And if it's $198 million per life saved, that sounds like not a good thing to do. But where to draw the line is the part that any sensible person will run away screaming from trying to answer that question.
Pauly says federal lawmakers should draw the line, but they don't seem eager to do that. So it may be up to ACIP. and the meningococcal vaccine may be what forces the issue. In April, the FDA approved a two-dose version for infants and toddlers. That means it will soon be possible to protect even very young children. But the cost could reach $1 billion a year, and ACIP will have to decide whether it's worth it. John Hamilton, NPR News.
And finally, a story that shows doctors aren't the only ones who can keep you healthy. Centering is a relatively new trend among pregnant women.
Yeah, see, throughout their pregnancies, women get together regularly at health centers for a little group checkup with a nurse or a midwife. They talk about medical issues and learn to monitor their own pregnancies and probably also talk about the husbands, too.
As part of NPR's series Beginnings, Pregnancy, Childbirth, and Beyond, Michelle Norris visited with one group of expectant moms.
I'm in Columbia Heights. It's a neighborhood in Washington, D.C. that's not very far from downtown. It's an area where there's been a lot of recent building. There are shiny new condominiums up and down the street. There's a lot of new retail establishments. There's a lot of diversity here, socioeconomic diversity and racial diversity. All the recent gentrification almost swallows up some of the pockets of poverty. And the building I came to visit sits in one of those pockets. It's a health center run by Unity Healthcare. The majority of patients here are uninsured or receive Medicare, and over 90% live below the poverty line. I'm here to learn more about a growing trend in prenatal care. It's called centering, and inside this building, I'm going to find out how it works. A group of women have collective two-hour-long medical visits throughout their pregnancies. It's a model that combines traditional prenatal care with something much like a coffee klatch.
In this group at Unity, all six patients are Hispanic and all in the same late stage of pregnancy. They're in a tight, windowless, cinder block room, a circle of bulging bellies. There's not idle time spent thumbing through waiting room magazines. The women get down to business as soon as they arrive. As music plays in one corner, they check their own vital signs at a table behind the door.
It's awesome to see them take their blood pressure and say, this is my blood pressure and it's normal. Or my urine dip's a little bit off. Like, wow, you know, that's pretty cool that they know that.
That's Ana Luisa Ralston, a nurse midwife at Unity. Through the course of the visit, the mothers-to-be take turns on a low metal cot and have their bellies measured by her. She also listens for fetal heartbeats. After all the vitals are checked, next, a discussion. The women settle into comfortable chairs, most with hands resting on their belly bump. This, too, is part of that centering model. Women get advice from nurses and from each other on things like nutrition, postpartum depression, and breastfeeding. To help the women understand how to position a newborn at their breast, Ralston talks about how far a newborn can see.
Bebé de la chichi de la mamá a la cara de su mamita.
Wow. It's the distance between the baby and its mommy's breast. Wow. Look, the hair on my arms is raised. A little baby has limited vision. They're able to see about as far as the distance between the mother's breast and her face. They can't see any further, because the only thing that matters for that baby when it leaves its mom's belly is seeing its mom.
Es increíble. Increíble.
And since the women spend so much time together, they build enough trust to tackle sensitive subjects like domestic violence or family tension, things that doctors can't easily address in a quick office visit. The goal is to provide a place where women, who often live far away from immediate family, can find support.
When you don't know about this, or you don't have like other pregnant ladies going through the same thing, you freak out. You don't know if what's happening to you is normal. What if something's wrong? And then you come here and everybody's like, oh, yes, I'm tired. I can't eat this. I can't smell that. All sorts of stuff. And you're like, oh, then I guess it's normal.
That's Ruth Lopez. She's 34 weeks pregnant. Her black hair hangs straight and long. And yes, she does seem tired. Like most of the other women in the program, she was referred by a doctor who thought she might benefit from a circle of support. The centering model offers benefits for healthcare workers as well by maximizing the time they spend with patients. there are more opportunities to eavesdrop, to give advice, and to help women become advocates for themselves and for their children. That last thing will potentially have a lasting impact, says Dr. Andrea Anderson. She's worked as a family physician at Unity for 7 years.
It's important to us to encourage our patients to help them take ownership over their own bodies, their own pregnancies, be able to plan their pregnancies, be able to have healthy babies, and to really feel like they're a player at the table in their own health care.
Putting health care in patients' hands. That's one of the main goals behind Centering. The model was created in 1993 by nurse midwife Sharon Schindler Rising. Rising says she got tired of answering the same questions over and over again.
I just felt women have so much wisdom inside, but not a lot of opportunity to test it out with the healthcare system. The big challenge for the provider is to be quiet and not answer questions, because the minute you answer a question, you won't know the group wisdom. So what happened to me as I was listening to women talk in the groups is I started having a real appreciation for cultural beliefs and values that I just didn't understand. And I would be thinking to myself, well, that's why that strategy never worked, because I didn't really understand.
What role does peer pressure play in the Centering model?
I think that one of the things that we see is the support for behavior change. In one of the groups, I heard one woman look at another woman and say, "I don't know how you can continue to keep smoking, putting that horrible stuff in your body. You know where it goes." And I stopped when I got pregnant. And I'll just tell you that if I can stop, you can stop, and I'm here to help you with that. Well, that isn't anything I could ever say. So there's tremendous power in the group, and that doesn't happen in individual care.
In reading about this, and forgive me if I'm wrong, but in reading about this, it seems like a lot of these programs are most often offered to low-income women, even though everything suggests that women at all income levels and all socioeconomic levels might benefit from this.
The vulnerable population has the most to gain in terms of outcomes. And the providers and agencies that are providing care to this population are the most open to change.
Okay. Bueno, vamos a darle un abrazo a Mercedes porque a lo mejor es...
Back at Unity, the team says the Centering model has improved birth outcomes for the 98 women who've completed the program over the past 2 years. They hope it will be available to more pregnant women in the future, and they hope it eventually might also become a model for pediatric visits once children are born.
Well, April, that's all for Your Health.
It is.
Our weekly podcast. Thanks to our health blogger, Scott Hensley, for stopping by to talk with us today. And to our intern, Maureen Langlois.
And as always, you can see all the newest blog posts or browse through our archives at npr.org/shots. Thanks for listening.
We're those cowgirls from Tahiti, are playing footsie with my best friend. There's a sunset lasting forever somewhere over there in that old west end. We're the song of the island.